This interview with Professor Ramsey McMullen of Yale University was conducted in November 2009. Professor McMullen, you're the author of a book called The Second Church that was published by the SBL. Why don't you start by telling us what it's about?
I think if someone of sort of casual interest picked it up and looked in it, flipping the pages, the first thing you would notice is there are a lot of pictures in it, 50 or more. And aside from making it sort of attractive in that way, it also reveals the real intent and character of the book, which is to invite a careful glance into the archaeological remains, which tell us about a particular time, the 200s and 300s of the Christian era, when there were big changes in the fortunes of the church, and they are reflected not only in a huge body of written material, but a really very big body of archaeological material, too. The thing that interested me was that the written material, which is literally tens of thousands of pages and adequate for the familiar picture of the growing and established Christian church, is written by and for bishops, with hardly any exceptions. And they, in their church manuals and the church councils with their decrees and in their private correspondence and their theological tractates and tons and tons and tons of sermons, literally by the thousands, give you a wonderful written basis for the understanding of the community they draw from, but an understanding which is from the top down and not very far down, because naturally bishops talk about bishops and their concerns, which are administrative and leadership and reflect the social world they come from. You can't help thinking there must have been another world, and the way to get at that is by a careful but not unimaginative look into the excavated remains of the places where Christians gathered for worship. So that latter is the emphasis of my book.
So the second church you refer to in your title refers to the non-elite in the Christian population?
Yes, just so. The second church is everything which is left over that's truly Christian after you have taken away what I'll call the first church, which is the one we're familiar with. It's the world of the hierarchy, of the clergy, of the literate, and of the increasingly well-to-do and important people after the conversion of Constantine. Before Constantine's conversion in 312, the picture we have of the church is one of a reasonably accurate image of the secular world, the entire population of the empire, minus some of the upper class contingent that you would find in a big or small town. But after 312, the social composition of the church population changed quite quickly.
Do you know what percentage of Christians after 312 were these, quote, elites, and how many were just everyday people?
It's very hard to estimate percentages inside the church, because while you can count bishops, the trick is to count how many Christians there were of which the bishops were a percentage. In other words, what was the total population of people who called themselves Christians? And that figure can't be known. I think it is vastly smaller than you would expect from the ordinary books you read about the early history of the church. And the reason I say that is that the archaeological remains present us with literally hundreds of basilicas, early churches, from after Constantine, that is beginning in 312, the ground floor of which is well enough preserved so you can measure the square footage. And looking at the square footage and calculating how many people you could jam in there on a sunny Easter when you would get the maximum attendance, you can then take a pretty good guess, I think a hard physical guess, at how many people there were in that particular town who would attend a formal service by a bishop. When you do that, you discover that the first church, as I'll call it, had room for, say, in AD 350, 2%, maybe up to 8% of the town population. And that is a surprisingly and challengingly different figure than you would find in the ordinary perception of how popular and triumphant the church was post-Constantine. In fact, increasingly, as you look at the internal plans of churches, you find that they are squeezing out the worshiping population in order to make room for grander and more formal and impressive performances, we have to call them, of the liturgy. And that suggests that the in-city attendance at the first church, as I call it, meaning those in-city buildings presided over on big occasions by bishops, was really interested in the well-to-do, the leadership of the community, and for some reason the ordinary Christians in the town were not there, or were there in very small numbers. So the natural question is, where were they, how many were they, and what were they doing?
Yes, that's a good next question. I think you say in your book that the issue is not that the numbers of Christians needs to be lowered, but that they were practicing Christianity elsewhere, particularly in cemeteries, right?
That really is quite clearly the case. So if the growth and triumph of the church isn't registering in the first church, and you still believe that it took place, as I do, that the church grew very rapidly and vigorously after 312, then you have somehow to place those new Christians in a physical setting. And the answer for where they went for their worship was cemeteries. Earlier than 312, there are accounts, for instance, in Eusebius's History of the Church, to show that cemeteries were associated in the common mind among the non-Christians with periodic or regular or home meetings of the local Christians. But there isn't much affirmation of this, there isn't much hard evidence until you begin to excavate, and that takes you to a date after Constantine's conversion. At that point, you can begin to see the construction of large buildings, larger and larger, to accommodate Christian crowds in the cemeteries, and they have a double character, which is surprising and extremely interesting. It is a character of worship in which an early and very important element is the worship of saints. And a great many of the structures that are excavated outside of cities in North Africa, in Greece, wherever, show a particular dedication to the memory of some particular local hero, usually a martyr, as time goes on, also a revered bishop. But in addition to the focus on its heroes, the local Christian population continued in the worship that's most simply called ancestor worship, even though it wasn't always your grandmother or your great-grandmother. In the nature of things, people the generation up die ahead of the living. But occasionally there was worship of a beloved son who never lived past 20 and who was revered by the family on the day of his death and successive days shortly after his real death, and then every year on his death day by a communion picnic, a kind of loving get-together for the family to dine out when the weather was clement or under cover if it wasn't, and bring their own food, bring their own drink, bring every member of the family who wanted to come, and hang out together, remembering dear old so-and-so up the line. Well, it was imagined, and there is plenty of archaeological equipment to help you picture the scene. It was imagined that the dear deceased were in their graves and their tombs listening to you, half asleep, but they could be reached. And it was a nice thing to share some of your food with them, which in due course the rain would wash away or the birds would take care of, and also to make a tribute to them of a glass of wine which you'd pour over the tomb or the grave site, or in many graves pour down a hole in the stone slab that was on top of the sarcophagus. These slabs, called tabletops in Latin, mensa, have been found generally busted up in hundreds all over the empire and frequently carved to suggest repositories, places to put this or that thing that you were eating, whatever is on the menu that the family brought out to the cemetery, with a hole in the middle where you could pour in the wine. And sometimes there will be a metal tube running down from the hole into the burial, maybe a sarcophagus of the deceased, right over the head, so that the dear deceased can get a taste of the good times going on above ground. The Latin term for these family meetings of communion with the dead was sometimes refrigerium, which means, as I translate it colloquially, a chill out, or in the Latin term laetitia, a joyful, which gives you the mood of the thing. A happy thing, and as the first church begins to notice what a laetitia is, it doesn't like it. The bishops find the style of behavior sort of gross. They are from the best of society, with the most polished manners. They've all been to graduate school and literary studies to take them into law or administration. They are a highly civilized bunch of people by the year 400, let's say, and they're really offended by the hoots and backslapping and laughing that they hear going on in the cemeteries and in built churches, because the custom of ancestor worship was accommodated in built churches, specifically for ancestor worship and not for regular church services, on quite a handsome scale.
So you find a different floor plan?
You find the entire floor of a church, one unbroken spread of mensae, tabletop slabs, marking the grave of dear old X or dear old Y with the name and often the death day of the deceased as a reminder to the family when to come. The entire floor of the church is a declaration of ancestor worship, and the most spectacular examples are in fact mostly bankrolled by Constantine when he was still in the Western Empire, still living in Italy, still had his capital in the city of Rome, and there paid for what the local bishop requested. Most famous, the Church of Christ, which turned into the Lateran Basilica, and next to it a palace for the bishop inside the city. But then in the cemetery, besides St. Peter's, which was for saints' worship and had ancestor worship that went on in it also. Besides St. Peter's, another 6 special buildings, 2 of them as big as St. Peter's, gigantic structures, which look exactly like cathedrals, but are not equipped with an altar or a pulpit or anything else for the usual first church service. Their purpose was for the proper housing and dignifying of ancestor worship.
What about house churches? What were they like?
I have to say about the house churches that there is only one that's been excavated, which people are perfectly certain about, and it happens to have been excavated by a Yale prof along with a famous Belgian prof on the banks of the Euphrates. That was in the city which was originally called Dura, and then when it was folded into a Greek empire, got the Greek name Europas. And so you read about it, hyphenated Dura Europas. And there in...
which is now modern-day northern Syria?
Right, in modern Syria, right on the overlooking the river Euphrates. And there, in what was a little bit like Pompeii, that is a rediscovered town, not quite a small one, among the reuse of buildings in order to turn them into worship places, some non-Christian, one Christian, one, another Jewish, the Christian one had a very well-preserved and now very famous baptistery where the font is well-preserved and some wall paintings which would be used at the time of baptism, adult baptism, as teaching models, sort of like PowerPoint for adults who needed to be instructed in what was being taught there. Incidentally, what was being taught was apparently not absolutely mainline Christianity, but Christianity in the 200s, when these paintings were done, say 225, 240, Christianity was a vibrant and various belief system with many local tweaks and differences, not to mention a variety of heresies.
Do you think a 21st century churchgoer might recognize the liturgy of an early house church?
There is no indication of liturgy, the sequence of what was done in services at Dura that I'm aware of. On the other hand, I think most people who are much better informed about the synaxary, as it's called, of course, the flow of action and words that constitute divine service ending in the Eucharist, would say that the church manuals, of which we have 4 strung out from the mid-200s into the late 300s, reflect quite a good deal of uniformity in those liturgical matters and the theology they build on, and do so across a worshiping population that is at its western end Rome and at its eastern end Syria, let's say Antioch, so that because of this degree of uniformity, it's a comfortable guess that what was being taught in Dura would not be totally different or shocking to a Christian today. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.